Welcome to Here and There, the podcast of the Germanic American Institute. This is Günther hosting, and in today's episode, we welcome Dr. Priscilla Lane. Now, before we jump into the episode, allow me a short introduction. Dr. Lane is presently a professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Her academic background is in comparative literature of the University of Chicago, with a master's degree and a PhD from the University of California in Berkeley. Particularly interesting is Dr. Lane's dissertation topic, Black Voices, German Rebels, Acts of Masculinity in Postwar German Culture. Certainly something we will unpack throughout the hour. Dr. Lane also speaks German at almost native level. In true academic fashion, though, Dr. Lane has chaired dissertations or was in the function of dissertation committee member. She also authored and published papers, edited books, reviewed books, and has given oral presentations. In all, as a fellow academic, I would gently consider her a publishing machine. The list of Dr. Lane's papers is quite lengthy, including Space is the Place, Afrotourism in Olivia Wenzel's Mein in Deutschland und anderen Galaxien, and The Darkening of Europe, Afrotourist Ambitions and Afro-Pessimist Fears in Damir Lukacevic's dystopian film Transfer. This is the podcast of the Germanic American Institute.
Welcome.
Willkommen.
Where Germanic-speaking European countries,
Germany,
Deutschland,
Austria,
Österreich,
Switzerland,
Schweiz,
blend with the Midwestern United States.
Hallo.
Hallo.
Servus.
Grüezi.
We are here and there, and we invite you to come along on the journey. Dr. Lane, welcome to Here and There.
Thank you. I'm happy to join you.
Well, thank you so much. And Audrey is here with us as well. Audra, good to see you.
Yes, good to see you too. Good to be back.
That was quite an introduction. And what I really latched onto were a couple of terms that I can perhaps map out in my brain, but I don't really truly understand what they mean. And that would be the term of Afrotourism and the darkening of Europe. So if I may just ask, how should we think about this?
So Afrofuturism is a term that was coined in the mid-90s by an American critic, Mark Deary. And he used it to describe Black artists who engage with sci-fi, fantasy, speculative fiction, often to kind of critique the experience of Black people in the Western world. So critique colonialism, critique racism. So when I've used it in my analysis of Black German texts, it's looking at, you know, plays, novels, short stories by Black Germans, where they similarly use fantasy, sci-fi to kind of explore Germany's colonial past, explore current problems with racism, and also imagine possible futures.
So the possible future, does that contribute to some degree to the darkening of Europe? Is there some evidence that we see in that?
So with that essay, that's about a sci-fi film, Transfer, which is not by a Black German director. It's actually by a Bosnian German director. And it's based on a Spanish story. So there I'm discussing more like European fears about what the future might hold, you know. So I feel like you see similar worries in the US. So we know that, you know, in 30, 50 years, America is going to be a lot more multicultural. That's just demographically the way that we're going. So I feel like in Europe, you have similar fears among the majority white population. Like, what will it look like in Germany if there are more and more people of color, if there are more Black people? So to me, that's partly what this German film is exploring, because in the film, elderly white Germans, if they get sick, so one character has cancer and, you know, is terminal, they're able to kind of rent bodies and have their minds transferred into them so that they have like a newer, younger body. And these bodies, unsurprisingly, tend to be from Africa, from Asia. And the idea is that in the future, because of global warming, people of color, people of African descent are, better equipped for the extreme temperatures. So that's the kind of justification given by the company that sells them these bodies. But part of it is also the knowledge that the people who kind of sign their bodies over for this process are from impoverished countries in Africa, war-torn countries. So they're looking for a way out. They're looking for a way to get more money to help their families. And this is their means. So I was kind of, in that essay, I was thinking, what is at play in this fantasy of, white Europeans renting African bodies? Like what different kinds of, I guess, hysteria, paranoia about the changing demographics of Europe, that the globalization can we find in this film?
So the underpinning of dystopia for sure, but at the same time, when I look through the history of film, where film frequently is a representation of the current mood, if you will, do we see some evidence, at least from your perspective, as you're evaluating film and voices, that there is growing concern, perhaps in Europe, much like you said here in the US, that we have the blending of cultures, the blending of races. What do we see in Europe based on that right now?
Well, yeah, there's actually an interesting article about this in Sci-Fi. I can't remember the author's name at present, but so in addition to Transfer, which is the film that I wrote about, there are a couple other films. One film is called Volt. I'd have to look up the other ones that all kind of toy with the issue of borders. So the borders of Europe, so what will it look like in 30 years if say, climate change has made certain parts of the world less habitable. If people are fleeing to the north, what could that mean for Europe? I think sci-fi often engages with these issues because I think it's Ursula Le Guin who said, sci-fi is not prescriptive, it's descriptive. So usually what a sci-fi author or director will do is they'll take a problem of the present, say climate change, immigration, and then just extrapolate it. Like, okay, what could this look like in 30 or 40 years? Mm-hmm. That's why, to me, sci-fi is definitely a good way of kind of taking the pulse of a nation and saying, okay, what issues are really worrying people right now?
So a bit of a forecast baked into what concerns present day Germans, perhaps.
Yeah, and sometimes it's a warning, about the path that the country is on. So one of my favorite films to teach is a South African film, District 9, where instead of undocumented immigrants or undocumented people, it's about aliens who crash, and are undocumented, and are kind of restricted into this one zone and treated really poorly. And there, the director is saying, okay, what if something like this happened? If we encounter aliens and we treated them the way that we've treated, racialized people, like ethically, what does that look like? Should we change the way we think of, citizenship, belonging, et cetera? So, yeah, I think sci-fi films can often be very effective when they take the current means that we use, of border control and imprisonment and things like that, and just kind of ramp it up, make it more extreme as a kind of warning, saying like, we're on the wrong path, we need to find a different way. I guess the flip side of that would be utopian films that mm-hmm. that kind of try to think, okay, well, how can we do this differently? I'd say Octavia Butler, she's an African-American sci-fi author who has several texts that are more utopian, and that they try to reimagine how a community could live and, how we can better live sustainably and treat each other better.
Can I take you into the polar opposite for a second in terms of time? Since we're talking mm-hmm. sci-fi, I noticed that you recently taught a class headlined Hitler and Hollywood. We've done a fair bit of episodes on this podcast with the Jewish community and basically historic events, recounting, retelling some of the issues that were lived experiences in Germany and then brought over here, just trying to escape from the atrocities committed in Germany. And I think no German is actually wanting to ever deny that any of this happened. It is crystal clear that this is part of the history. At the same time, though, by continually revisiting, if you will, the fascination of that which was the genocide, we also are not really capable of silencing that label. I'm wondering, from your perspective, what contributes to this ongoing fascination that Hollywood just has to continually jump on this?
Well, I think, you know, Hollywood likes, you know, any story that allows for kind of extremes of emotion, you know, to come through. Like melodrama, you know, is very popular with audiences. I see that with my students. I can show them a melodrama from West Germany in the 50s. I can show them a melodrama from the 30s that the Nazis made, and both films will move them emotionally just because of how films manipulate us, you know? So I think there's something about the setting of Nazi Germany allows for this kind of just like over, you know, extreme emotions, whether it's anger or love or, you know, sadness, tragedy. And I think that tends to captivate audiences. But for me, one of the reasons I teach that class is because I found, you know, growing up in the US and having studied German history and culture, that for me, when I was in school, the narrative of World War II, the way it was told, it felt very simplistic in the idea that America was good, you know, the Americans went and fought the Nazis and Germany was bad. And the more I learned about this period, I realized, you know, there were a lot of bad things going on in the U.S. as well. There's anti-Semitism in the U.S. You know, there's a reason that it took American filmmakers a while to actually address this in their films. There was censorship. You know, initially they couldn't directly talk about Jewish victims and things like that. So when I teach this class, I say to my students, you know, you might be fascinated with this period because there's this notion that, you know, not only was this an extreme in German history, but only, you know, this could only happen in Germany. I try to warn them, no, like this could have happened in other places. This could happen now or in the future. And America, you know, had its own problems as well. And that's why it's important to learn from the past. You know, so, you know, one of the things, the exercises I take students through is, what is fascism? What is, you know, what is National Socialism? These are often words that they can't really define, you know, even if they think they know what it means. So for me, it's about, you know, really taking students through this history and helping them understand what enabled, you know, the rise of a dictator, you know, like Hitler, so that they're knowledgeable, you know, in the future, you know, are able to parse information and understand what really happened and understand what is so dangerous about dehumanizing, you know, groups of people.
When you teach that class, how do you notice the reset in the students' minds? Because the terms, certainly we can look them up what they mean, but by actually getting a feel for that which is expressed in movies, for instance, we have a little more emotional exposure to what the director wants us to feel. How does that affect your students?
Often students will tell me, you know, that they'll never look at a film the same way again. So I find that a lot of what they take from it is how to really understand how a film is put together and how it manipulates your emotions. Because I think there is this tendency, it's really easy for them to say, feel sympathy for a character, you know? So one of the movies I'll show them is, there's this Nazi propaganda film, Hitlerjugendkriegs. You know, it's about a Hitler youth who is killed by communists, you know. And throughout the film, you know, the music makes you want to feel bad for him, and his dad is abusive. And, you know, so there are all these elements that make you want to feel bad for him. But I keep reminding them, this is propaganda. You know, the Nazis wrote the story in a specific way to make you feel these emotions, to make you feel bad for him. And you have to keep that in the back of your mind. Okay, what is this film trying to do? What is the purpose of the film? And so I hope that coming out of the class, when students engage with any media, whether it's a film or an advertisement or something, that they always think, okay, who wrote this? You know, who directed it? What is their argument? You know, what, how is it constructed? So that they're just a little bit more critical, I guess, critical viewers than maybe they used to be in the past.
We again had some of the episodes dedicated to Hitler Germany and the experience of our Jewish friends here in the community in St. Paul and Minneapolis. And it's quite interesting when I remember those conversations. The narrative was a little more along the lines of when the stories were actively told with an active audience, it actually really gripped the audience and brought many students, many even adults, to tears and really to reflect upon that which happened to the storyteller. The question that I have outside of having this active engagement, how else can we actually keep such events at the forefront to not have it happen again? Because when I look at what's happening right now in the US, we are really not that far away from actually outcasting one group versus glorifying the other group. And this is also something that I think we see, for instance, in Austria right now. Long question short, if you will, how can we keep things that divide us at the forefront of our mind so that we actually don't fall victim to our own doings here?
Well, I think that empathy is a really important lesson to teach, you know, and it's not necessarily natural or automatic. You do have to teach it. And to me, part of teaching empathy is sharing stories. You know, I have an 8-year-old son. We have a book about Anne Frank, you know, written for a young person. And we read it the other night and he said, oh, why did this happen? And why did she have to hide? You know, so I think often people are afraid to talk to children about difficult topics. They think they're not ready. But I feel like there's so many great examples out there for you to have these conversations early on. Because to me, if you start working on empathy when they're young, by the time they're in high school and college, this isn't a new thing. You know, they're just building on this skill. One thing I read about the other day was this concept of a human library. So this idea that you can go to this place and kind of check humans out in the sense that you want to have a conversation with someone. So say you're a Democrat and you want to talk to a Republican, you know, or you're in favor of the vaccine and you want to talk to someone who's not. The whole point is that everyone who's present is saying, I'm open to a conversation, ask me whatever questions you want. And it's all about trying to gain an understanding. I really like that idea because I think if anything, more conversation is necessary, whether again, that's reading a narrative or just talking to someone. So if anything, it really worries me that the path that we're going, when I read about all the books that are being banned, the books that are being removed from the schools, because to me, a lot of these books are just about starting a conversation and about sharing different experiences with young people. And I feel like we need more of that, not less of it.
We are doing an exceptional job in echo chambering each other. That's for sure, which I do really like the idea of the human library. Just ask people questions and just listen to their stories. I think it's actually the epiphany is that we are closer together than we actually think we are. And it's only some fragments that truly built the division. And then there are those who capitalize on this division and actually do this quite handsomely. Audra.
Yeah, I had a question that definitely backtracks back to Afrofuturism a bit, but I was reading an article that you wrote that was on a website that I cannot remember the name of right now about Afrofuturism. And you wrote about xenophobia and like anti-blackness, like racism, and like how those two ideas are different. And I think often we kind of mix them together and we don't really talk about, so like in the context of Germany right now, how would you, I don't know, describe that difference? Or where is that divide? Where is that happening?
For me, the important distinction between xenophobia and anti-Black racism is that xenophobia is a fear of the foreign, right? But anti-Black racism is an attitude that can be directed at a Black person who is a German citizen, right? And so from my experience, you know, working on contemporary Germany and working, trying to understand the experiences of the Black German community, there are Black Germans, plenty of Black Germans who either, you know, have faced discrimination at the workplace or in school, or maybe were the victims of, you know, a racist attack on the street or something. And it's just frustrated me that then when I read in the newspaper about what happened, the explanation is xenophobia. Because for me, it's not xenophobia if the person who's being attacked is German, grew up in Germany, you know, acculturated in Germany, has a German citizenship. You know, instead it's racism against someone who belongs to your community. So that's a struggle that I've had in Germany, is that when I mention racism, often people will say, oh, but we don't have racism, because people like to like say compare and contrast the US, like, oh, well, the US has racism and we have something else. But I would argue that no, you know, you find anti-Black racism in Germany just as you would find it in the US.
So from a racism perspective, if we just describe the term racism, I think we come to a reasonably identical definition, whether that's Germany or the US. But from your perspective, how does racism differ between Germany and the US?
That's a tough question, because I feel like there's a lot of ways that they're similar. You know, I recently translated a novel by a Black German author. Her name is Olivia Wenzel. And the text is Ein Tausend Serpentin in Angst. And for me, there were examples in there where, you know, the border between the US and Germany was really disappearing. I mean, I think in terms of history, the US has maybe, racism has been a part of the conversation for longer, you know, from the Civil War, Reconstruction, you know, Black African-American people in government, you know, talking about it, you know, Jim Crow, the Black Power movement. So, there are all these historical periods where racism, you know, was at the forefront of political discussions. In Germany, I feel like, especially after World War II, there was, people didn't want to talk about race. You know, it's a taboo word. And so even though you may have found the same kinds of discrimination and racism in Germany as you did in the US, people didn't want to talk about it, or there wasn't really a language for it. So for me, that's maybe the biggest difference. I feel like there are certain terms in the US, you know, whether you say intersectionality, you know, anti-Black racism, that people are familiar with, you know, you can throw it out in the conversation, they know what you're talking about. In Germany, it often feels like among white Germans, there's still a lot of education that needs to be done, you know, about privilege, white privilege, things like that. But other than that, I would say that the way racism expresses itself is very similar. You have the same problems with, you know, police brutality. You have, you know, the way that undocumented refugees are treated, discrimination in the workplace or at school. So I would say, unfortunately, there are a lot of similarities, and I've had experiences with racism in both places.
Is it a generational occurrence as well?
I feel like young people are often more open to change, more accepting of change, you know, especially if they get introduced to new possibilities at an early age. But unfortunately, I would say that it's not necessarily a generational thing. I mean, if you have a young person who lives in a very closed, homogenous community where people are racist and afraid of difference, they're going to be espousing the same views as someone who's older. So I don't think age can protect you from these views. But often, if you begin a conversation very young, I think they're more open to hearing a new perspective. They're not as set in their ways in the terms of, oh, well, we've always done it this way, or it's always been like this, so why should we change, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah. To bring it to a more local level, I guess, on like a Minnesota level, like obviously we saw a lot happening in the past 2 years with the murder of George Floyd right here in Minneapolis. And it started here and it dispersed out, and we saw movements around the world, including Germany. Do you think that moment in time, I mean, because it really it seems to have faded now, unfortunately, but do you think that moment in time had a lasting impact internationally and on Germans and on anti-racist movements over there?
I mean, it's what part of what's hard for me to speak about that is that I unfortunately haven't been to Germany now since January 2019 because of the pandemic. You know, I normally go every summer and it just hasn't been possible. So I haven't been able to see for myself how, say, political demonstrations have changed. But a good friend of mine, who's Black German, Natasha Kelly, she recently wrote a book about racism in German, where she picks up on George Floyd and everything that happened last year. So it feels like, at least in terms of the discussion, that there's a certain momentum that happened because of that, and that people are trying to keep going. There were a few changes that I did catch wind of from here. I know that in Berlin, there was this street, it was called Moor Street, you know, that Black Germans had been campaigning to get the name changed for years, and that after that summer of 2020, the city finally said they would. So for me, that was like a real structural change that, okay, people are listening. But unfortunately, I just heard, you know, a week or two ago that there is some controversy going on at the Frankfurt Book Fair because this Black German author said she would no longer go because the head of the fair had invited a right-wing publisher who was supposed to be a few booths down from her, and she didn't feel safe. So then it feels like, oh, you know, like, I don't know, like there, I guess it's with every, when it comes to politics, there's always games and then you go a few steps back, and that might just be what's going on in Germany right now as well.
One of the hot button items in the US, and I presume, hopefully, maybe in Germany as well, is critical race theory. I haven't had the opportunity yet to think about introducing this at any one of my German classes, but what's your perspective on the pros and cons, if there are any cons, to teaching critical race theory?
I mean, when I heard that this, you know, hysteria around critical race theory was happening, I just thought it was ridiculous, because for me, it again, it's a theory. It's a theory that you tend to encounter in graduate school, you know, maybe college, but not, I wouldn't expect it in elementary school. So it felt like people's fears were really unfounded, because who's trying to teach theory, you know, to elementary school students? I think what this has morphed into is people taking issue with any kind of critical take on history, which is definitely a problem. And I mean, I don't know. From the perspective of a person of color, from the perspective of a Black person, I would say growing up in the US, most of history, I feel, was taught from a single perspective, an uncritical perspective. You know, whether we were learning about the Native Americans or about the experience of Black people. And so for me, the fact that teachers are now trying to bring in different perspectives and be more critical is welcomed. You know, I don't think history should be this taught in this kind of whitewashed, objective, if that's even possible, way where we're not critical of the US. I mean, that's doing a disservice to children, you know, because then they get out in the real world and they realize that's not the way it was. You know, I've heard this from my husband, who grew up in North Carolina, and says to me, everything I learned in school, I feel like it was a lie. You know, the more he learns about racism and the real history of the state. So for me, I mean, critical race theory, it evolved out of a certain moment in time. I think the origins are in law, actually. Mm-hmm. So people like, gosh, now I'm forgetting the name. Oh, sorry, I have to look it up. There's a law professor at Harvard, Derek Bell. You know, I think of Kimberly Crenshaw, who's a Black female lawyer who, you know, coined the term intersectionality to explain the Anita Hill case. I mean, these are people who are trying to explain what was going on in society, you know, like partly why are we still seeing racism despite the Civil Rights Act, you know, despite a lot of legal legal progress that was supposed to end racism. And so for me, that's why critical race theory is useful and is important, because it helps, you know, someone like me, you know, a Black person say, wait a second, we have, you know, the Civil Rights Act, we've had a Black president, we have all of this quote unquote progress, why am I still seeing these problems? You know, it helps answer that.
Yeah, I think from a teaching perspective, we can't start soon enough with critical race theory, because if we don't bring it in at the earliest opportunity, we will inevitably start with whitewashed history. So at that point, we have to unlearn things later down the road and bring in just simply more critical thought processes and really understand how society functions. So I would rather not have to unlearn something and teach it from the early beginnings. But that seems to create a little bit of a knee-jerk reaction in the U.S. Is there something similar going on in Germany that you're aware of?
I would say Germany is similar in the sense that there are certain narratives that people have always told that are comfortable. And once you start to challenge those narratives, they get upset. So I'll give an example from the US. So I didn't learn about redlining until I was an adult. You know, redlining is this practice that happened, I think it's, you know, the 50s, maybe even early, where Black families, you know, Black neighborhoods got a very low rating from realtors, you know, and it made it difficult for Black people to get a loan to buy a house. You know, there's also the fact that, you know, the GI Bill that was supposed to benefit, you know, soldiers coming back from the war to help them get an education or buy a house wasn't available for Black soldiers, right? So the effect of this is decades later, there's all of this generational wealth, you know, that white communities have, you know, and these houses that were bought by the grandparents and passed down, you know, whereas you don't see as many Black families, you know, owning a house or living in a certain neighborhood. Now, growing up, I would just think, oh, okay, the Black people didn't have as much money, I guess, you know, that's what I thought was the reason. And I feel like when you hear people try to explain this from an uncritical perspective, they say, oh, well, I guess the Black people didn't work hard enough, or I guess they didn't save their money. But the fact of the matter is that there were laws in place keeping them, you know, from these opportunities. So for me, something like critical race theory shows us the structures behind kind of lazy narratives that say, oh, well, Black people just don't work hard, or they don't save their money, or they don't know how to treat their money. And just like you have these, you know, narratives in the US, you have the same in Germany, you know, like the notion that Black people, yeah, don't work as hard in school, or, you know, aren't interested in certain jobs. And so for me, both white Americans and white Germans often like cling to these narratives, because it's an easy way of explaining with inequality. You know, you don't have to think about your own life, or, you know, how you may have benefited from certain policies, if you can just demonize the other group as, you know, being lazy or not being as smart. But once those views are challenged, I think then people often get insecure, or they feel they feel a bit threatened, you know, that this narrative that they've believed all their lives is not true.
Yeah, you talked briefly about redlining, and that's like, as someone who was in high school, like what, 4 or 5 years ago, when I was, the first time I heard that term was in an AP human geography class, and it was just kind of a vocab word, you learned it, but you never truly learned the effects of it. And I think that's really where things like critical race theory come into play, because we just kind of talked about it. It was an answer on a quiz or a test or whatever. We never actually talked about the impact, or like gerrymandering was the same way. Like, we didn't talk about those things.
Yeah. Well, the same, since you mentioned real estate, the same applied to the idea of steering, where agents were actively involved of steering their buyers into certain communities that were just simply more suitable based on their perspective. And this has since been quite sternly outlawed by the National Association of Realtors. So everybody's supposed to abide by those rules and regulations, to not steer, to not redline from a financing perspective. And I think this has certainly contributed to a lot of positive change. But then I look at, for instance, here in St. Paul, with the manner in which the highway was repositioned, cutting right through a predominantly black neighborhood, truly cutting the city in half, if you will. And even though there is presently talk about perhaps covering the highway up with sort of an overpass, if you will, and making it a green space to rebuild that connection, I think maybe some things that were broken cannot be repaired. Could this be a sensation that also takes place, that some things are simply so far gone that they are irreparable?
Yeah, I think about that, because, you know, it's great that they want to address this highway. And by the way, this is such a frequent story. You know, I used to live in Oakland. The same thing happened in Oakland. The same thing happened in Durham, you know, which is down the street from where I live. And yeah, I wonder, like, okay, you want to change it now, but it's, the community was already damaged, you know, for decades. Like, how long will it take them to recover? You know, all of the like Black Wall Streets that at some point existed, and the businesses suffered. But I do think that, you know, the older I get, the more I feel like economics is often the answer, at least to starting to address the problem. So I think investing in Black businesses, putting your money in a Black bank, I've been trying increasingly to find Black businesses to give my money to. There's a professor at Duke University, Sandy Darity, who talks about reparations in the form of baby bonds. So I think that there is a lot that can be done economically. But yeah, that it's at least a start. And I think every person has to reevaluate, like, how can I look, you know, make sure that I'm investing in the Black community with my money as well, you know, so that these communities can turn around and, you know, regain that wealth that they once had.
What do you hope to change?
I just hope that I am able to get my students to think more critically, you know, to, you know, whatever beliefs they are that they brought, you know, from growing up, that they are able to reflect on that and wonder, why do I believe this? Do I still believe it? That they're able to, you know, what's the word? Receive new information and then reassess their beliefs. I mean, to me, no beliefs are stuck in stone. You know, I'm able to hear other perspectives and then, you know, reflect on whether, okay, did you change my mind? Or do I still believe, you know, what I believed before? So to me, that's one of the main things that I hope to give my students, you know, who come through my classes. And I guess, yeah, again, the lesson of empathy, because they say empathy is something that can be taught, especially through reading fiction. And so, yeah, I hope that in my classes where we read, whether we're reading a text from the 18th century or a text by a Black German or Turkish German author, that for the students, it's not about, okay, it's not just about like, how am I similar to or different from the character, but what can I learn about this experience that kind of helps me, I guess, engage in a more empathetic, understanding way with my environment.
So with your in-depth understanding and obviously representing the Black collegiate community, if you will, have you encountered racism in the classroom?
I would say not directed at me necessarily. I've never had a white student say something racist to me. I've heard them make assumptions, you know, about a text or a film that I would say is rooted in racism. I've had students will sometimes think that I can't speak German. So I teach in English sometimes too. And so I've had a student say to me, do you speak German, Dr. Lane? And I just think, if I were white, would you be asking me that question? Because I tell them, what do you mean, do I speak German? Like, I'm actively translating titles for you, you know? But there I feel like it's because it's uncommon for them to think of a German professor who's Black. I realize that. So, but I would say that's the extent of racism or maybe racialized thinking I've encountered. I have to say that, you know, I was pleasantly surprised that the students that I have had for the last 10 years in North Carolina have been very open and curious and respectful. And it's been really fun, engaging with them about the material that I've presented them with and just hearing their observations and seeing how they change, you know, over the course of 4 years.
I would have expected a little more combative answer there, in a sense that you had to overcome some obstacles. But I suppose the answer that you had and the experiences that you had so far are perhaps a testament that we've actually come a long way.
Yeah, I mean, so I remember in one class, I was teaching the cinematic representations of Nazis class. And I ended the class with this satirical film that used to be available on Netflix, where this actor basically dresses up like Hitler and pretends that Hitler like woke up in say 2018 and is walking around Berlin. And so I showed them clips from this film. And at the end of the film, there's kind of this montage of anti-refugee protests throughout Europe and kind of suggesting like, oh no, you know, it's history repeating itself. So I showed this to the class. I remember one student saying, yeah, but you know, the immigrants, like, we don't have to let them into our country. And, you know, we have laws for a reason, et cetera. And, you know, with that student, I just, you know, I pushed back. I said, okay, but, you know, why are they seeking to come here? You know, like, what kind of harm do they really pose? Like, how can we argue against what you just said? So for me, that comment, yes, I would say that student was coming from a very, you know, judgmental place, you know, about his thoughts about undocumented immigrants. But I think part of why I haven't encountered much racist thinking is because I don't tell my students what to think. You know, I try to ask them questions mostly. So I think that has created an environment in the classroom that's not combative. Because they don't think that, oh, I have to say this or the teacher's going to give me a bad grade or the teacher wants to hear this from me. I make it clear to them, I'm not telling you what the right answer is. There is no right answer. I just want to hear what you think. And I want you to question each other. You know? So that's, I would say, is normally the atmosphere in the classroom is more discursive, just kind of, you know, sharing ideas and things like that.
With being in the classroom, there is kind of this movement happening with language learning where what it means to be a native like speaker of German looks different than it used to. Like, it's not just Germans teaching German and Austrians, sorry, Günther, teaching German and whatever. It's, I mean, a lot of your work focuses on Turkish German speakers and like, obviously there's some slight differences, but I mean, what have been your observations with who is teaching now?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the landscape of who's teaching German is becoming more and more diverse. I'm currently vice president of the American Association of Teachers of German. I'll be president starting in January. And, you know, when I hear from our members, I hear from members who are, you know, of African descent, of Asian descent, of Turkish descent, you know, like there's such a wide variety of teachers, you know, instructors of German. And it's really nice to see, you know, because I remember when I started learning German in seventh grade, you know, my German teacher, she was a German immigrant. You know, she'd immigrated to the US. Actually my classroom was pretty diverse. I remember there was a kid who was Japanese and German. There was a kid who was German but Brazilian, you know. So for me, that's, I really hope that's the future of German classrooms, because I have heard from a student at UNC, you know, who said that German is a white language, you know, and that really troubled me to hear that, because I thought, well, what do they mean, like, that people of color don't speak German, you know, that there are no people of color who, you know, are German citizens. And for for me, that's really the view of German that I'd like to change, because I don't, Germany has been diverse for many, many decades now. And, you know, people of color, African-Americans even, have been interested in German since, you know, for centuries. So I feel like there's always been this exchange. And it's just about, you know, uncovering that history and letting people know that it exists, kind of change people's very narrow view of what German is, or who can speak German and who can teach German.
Right. And unfortunately, like, German programs are disappearing. My German program at my school that I graduated from this past spring, I was the last one to graduate from my German program while it still existed at the institution. Günther was actually my professor at said institution, even though it was mentioned earlier. But I mean, do you have any, like, I don't know, what do you think, why do you think that's happening? Do you think it's because people are seeing German as a white language, or I don't know, where does that come from? Why is it disappearing?
I mean, there's probably a number of factors. I mean, financially, I would ask, like, how much, as a country, how much do we invest in foreign language teaching? Do we think of foreign language as important? A lot of times it's not the case. And then unfortunately, when we do think foreign language is important, we'll narrow it down, you know? So, you know, in the 50s, maybe in the 50s and 60s, it was like German and Russian or something, you know, in the Cold War days. And now people say, well, okay, Spanish and Mandarin are important, but other languages are not. And so for me, a big way of combating the closure of programs is to advocate for all foreign languages, like that learning any foreign language is important, will help, you know, expand your mind, make you more culturally competent and aware, and, you know, it's good, a good skill, you know, for your brain. And so for me, German is just one among many languages that, you know, that would be wonderful to learn. I mean, I also, for German specifically, I try to stress the important role that Germany plays in the EU, the important role Germany has always played in, you know, world politics. And, you know, American-German relations have been, you know, a focal point for a long time. But yeah, unfortunately, you know, for a lot of programs that are already in the act of closing, it can be too late. So I guess, yeah, in the future, I guess advocate more for foreign languages, try to get it into the minds of not only principals and chancellors, but also politicians, you know, that learning a foreign language is important. But also, as you were saying, like combating the idea that German is a white language, and also emphasizing German, how German can function alongside other disciplines. So like at the University of Rhode Island, they've had some really great work linking German with engineering, you know, German and STEM. So that I think there's a lot of possibility for ways that German can work alongside, you know, other disciplines. That might be the future of trying to save the programs.
As far as the continuation of German goes at various institutions, one of the things that I've noticed that give me great pause when I look at the German language in particular, and when I look at our recent teaching materials, I see more and more English terms that kind of infuse themselves through technology, through various social media and whatnot, into the German language. So there is sort of a hybrid version suddenly that exists with several thousand English terms being embedded within the German language. Is there perhaps the concern, and this is, again, sort of an open question because I'm wrestling with this myself, is there this blending taking place that essentially obfuscates the language to a degree that that truly teaching German in and of itself is almost no longer needed because we can communicate in sort of this mix that is more and more becoming English?
Man, the way I like to see it is that languages are always changing, right? Mm-hmm. Language is a living thing. And just like, you know, centuries ago, German swallowed or like absorbed a bunch of French words, right? So currently it's English words. Maybe in the future it'll be Mandarin words. But to me, despite these changes, like when I read a novel by a German author or a poem, like, so there's this one poet actually that I recently translated some texts by. Her last name is Aseva, a Black German poet of Ethiopian descent. She's got this one poem that was really fascinating because it was about social media. And there are all of these like Englishisms, you know, like auf Instagram and Twitter, you know, and texting and, you know, where it was like Google. And so there's all these like recent social media words where it was clear they took English and Germanized it. But then in other cases, you know, we were translating these German poems into English. And I remember like talking to my co-translator and like mulling over this one German word, like, oh, there's five different English words it could be and what should we choose? So to me, despite all of the English words that may find their way into the German language, there's a certain character of German that I think will never be lost, and will require that students learn German, whether it's for reading older texts or just by, I don't know, understanding the nuance between, okay, so today I've been working on this book about Fassbinder's film, Die Ehe der Maria Braun. And there's this line where Maria says, ich habe ihn lieb gehabt, aber ich liebe meinen Mann, right? And I just love that, lieb haben versus lieben. What, you know, what's the difference? Trying to explain that to an English speaker. To me, those are the nuances of German that will always be important for the language, and that artists and authors are always going to play with, because an author ultimately, you know, writing a novel or a poem, you have to love language, you know, and you have to know the language really well and want to like mull over all the 50 different ways you can say something. And so for me, the language will always be alive, you know, for as long as there's literature, you know, as long as there's art, German will be alive beyond, you know, these kind of English, these Germanized English terms that we find.
You're giving me great hope for the future. Thank you very much on that.
Good.
I think we just need to embark on a mission to bring some more German vocabulary into the language, into the English language, just reverse the tables a little bit.
Do you have a book that you're working on, right?
Yes, I have a book on Afrofuturism that will hopefully come out next year. I just finished the revisions of it. I'm working with Northwestern University Press. So I'm waiting to hear if they have any more requests for changes or not. But I will definitely let you both know, you know, when it's expected to be out.
Yeah, so we'll do the usual podcast thing where you go on tour and we'll talk about your book. I actually really like that idea.
Yeah.
Dr. Lane, thank you so much for joining us today. That was a great experience to have you on. All right, Audra, thank you so much also for being here.
Absolutely.
Dr. Lane, one more time, thank you so much.
Yep, thank you both.
And we'll talk to you again soon. This was another episode of Here and There, the podcast of the Germanic American Institute with Dr. Priscilla Lane. More to come in the future.